I'm Bert Cohen, and it's the Bert Cohen Show. Dreams of Freedom. That is what America is all about. And that actually is from a song that I may have first heard at the 1988 Democratic Convention when the Democratic Party nominee was Michael Dukakis. And I'm very, very pleased to have Governor Dukakis with us today on the Bert Cohen Show. Governor, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Bert.
Well, just a bit of introduction. There may be some people who don't know that much about Governor Dukakis. He was the Democratic presidential nominee in 1988 and was governor of Massachusetts from 1975 through 79, and again from 1983 to 1991. And this must have been very pleasant. In 1986, he won with nearly 70% of the vote, during which time he presided over a high-tech boom and a period of prosperity in Massachusetts, earning the reputation for being a technocrat, a new term at the time. The National Governors Association voted Mike Dukakis as the most effective governor in the nation in 1986. He made major improvements to Boston's mass transit system and was known as the only governor who rode the subway to work every day. Mr. Dukakis was the first candidate to ever win a contested New Hampshire primary by more than 10 points. And he stated proudly in his presidential run that he was a card-carrying member of the American Civil Liberties Union. He vetoed legislation requiring public school teachers to lead pupils in the Pledge of Allegiance and his opposition to the resumption of capital punishment in the United States. In 2009, after the death of Ted Kennedy, Mike Dukakis was one of two leading candidates as a possible interim successor. Governor Dukakis, how do you think it would go over today for a presidential candidate to declare he was a card-carrying member of the ACLU? What do you think has happened to civil liberties as enshrined by the First Amendment? Do people still care about it?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that they do, Bert. I'm not sure I explained this as well as I should have in 1988, but the ACLU does not discriminate. I mean, they will represent and advocate for people, whether they're right, left, or center, if they think their civil liberties have been abused. And in point of fact, at that time, they were representing a young colonel who, as we'll recall, was in the White House during the Iran-Contra scandal and was involved in burning documents and all that kind of stuff, and they represented him. Now, he's gone on to become a fairly popular right-wing talk show host down in the D.C. area, but I've always felt that the ACLU was an important safeguard for all of us when it comes to defending our civil rights and civil liberties. And I don't think it makes an awful lot of difference whether you're liberal or conservative. These are basic principles, and I think we're doing better these days, certainly than the McCarthy era, which I remember very vividly, and which was really a terrible period in American history. And it was at that time, in many ways, that the ACLU really came into its own and quadrupled its membership and became a real force in this country.
Yeah, and I would think that it doesn't matter if you're a liberal or a conservative. The First Amendment freedom is kind of what it really should be all about.
That's right.
You were hurt by your alleged lack of passion back in 1988. And today we have no drama Obama. Should it be important? Is it necessary for a candidate to show passion? Or maybe you were just ahead of your time?
Well, you know, one of the most difficult things, Bert, about running for the presidency, and needless to say, you run for a year and a half or two, so you're out there incessantly, is trying to give people a good sense of who you are, what kind of a person you are. And I think that's important. I don't know that I did that terribly well. I mean, anybody who knows me knows I'm very passionate about things and I'm very committed to things. And, you know, I didn't get elected governor for 12 years in the state of Massachusetts because I was a technocrat or a bloodless technocrat or whatever this kind of nonsense was. Does Barack Obama feel passionately about the kinds of issues that he is committed to? Does he care deeply about the fact that all Americans, and especially working people and their families, ought to have decent and affordable health insurance? There's no question about
it.
He wouldn't have run for the presidency in the first place. On the other hand, he is a guy that thinks, that listens, that spends time making decisions. And I'd much rather have that kind of president than the guy that preceded him, who oftentimes seemed to make decisions in about 10 minutes, some of which got us into very, very big trouble. So I don't think you have to worry about his passion. But it is very important, particularly these days, I think, to have a very steady hand at the throttle in the White House, and that's what we have. And whether one agrees with him or not, I think the fact that he is a guy that thinks, that deliberates, that reaches out to people, that brings them into the process, that tries to build bipartisan support for what he's doing has been extremely difficult, given the basic attitude of the Republicans in Congress these days, which seems to be to oppose everything. But he's plenty passionate, let me tell you. And if he weren't, he wouldn't have won the presidency, and he wouldn't be in the office that he currently holds.
And it's true. I don't know you that well, but you certainly have passion for a lot of issues. Always have. What are you passionate about these days?
Other than my dear wife and my kids and eight grandkids, the eighth of which arrived 3 months ago. Look, I care very deeply about this country. I'm particularly concerned about the vast majority of Americans who aren't in the wealthiest 5 or 10% of the population and really are now, on average, making less in real terms than they were 30 years ago. And our failure to make it possible for all Americans, not just the folks at the top, to experience the benefits of an expanding economy when we had an expanding economy. I think our failure to guarantee basic and affordable health insurance to working people and their families, you know, this fight is all about working people. It's not about people that are loafing or on welfare. They already get health insurance through Medicaid. These are working people. 85% of the folks that are uninsured in this country are working and members of working families. I think it's just outrageous that we don't provide that basic guarantee. I care deeply about kids, about schools. I'm very proud of the fact that Massachusetts has the best schools in the country and has been rated so by the United States Department of Education 3 years in a row. But we ought to start telling people that and saying thank you to teachers and principals and parents and taxpayers who have made it possible. And I care about a lot of things that that I think are important. And these days, I teach and teach a lot. I'm a missionary for public service. I love working with young people and encouraging them to go into public service. So life continues to be busy, and I continue to feel very strongly about this country and its future and what we're doing to create real opportunity for all Americans, not just a small minority at the top of the pile.
We are talking with Governor Michael Dukakis, 1988 candidate for president. I will acknowledge I was on his team. I was proud to be a delegate to the Democratic National Convention when Mike Dukakis was the nominee. And I remember, Governor, and you may as well, I think it was the keynote speaker who spoke and spoke and spoke for a very, very long time. And when this keynote speaker said, and finally, there was a big cheer that went up, and that was Bill Clinton, I believe.
Well, it wasn't his fault. We had taken a look at his speech. All of a sudden, it was a good one. It just turned out it was longer than it should have been. But I wouldn't blame him for that. And I remember when he decided to run for the presidency, and I think he did Johnny Carsonberg soon after he announced. And Carson said, "Why are you running for the presidency?" He said, "Because I want to finish my speech for Dukakis." Well, but he went on to be a successful president.
Yeah.
Good one. So
absolutely.
Maybe that keynote got him started.
Well, there's a lot of different subjects to talk about, a lot of ground to cover. About Massachusetts, which you know pretty well, what do you make of the latest polls in Massachusetts showing that Scott Brown apparently is more popular than Senator John Kerry or even President Obama? What's happened to Massachusetts?
Well, what happened to Martha Coakley is exactly what happened to me in 1978 when Ed King beat me in the Democratic primary. We had been through very tough times. As a matter of fact, the recession of 74 and 75 was far worse, at least in Massachusetts and the Northeast, as you recall.
That's true.
We were the new Appalachia. Massachusetts had the second highest unemployment rate in the country. We were over 12%. And although by 1978, my fourth year in office, we were down to 5%. And we had begun to straighten out a lot of our basic problems, and I felt pretty good about things. And by the way, it was 40 points ahead in the polls with 5 weeks to go. There was still this lingering unhappiness and anger out there, which caught me by surprise and led to my defeat. And it took me 4 years to get back to the governor's office. And I think that's essentially what happened with Brown. Now, look, he's really hasn't been tested. I mean, he's casting some votes which, in my judgment, are not in the best interest of the country or the people of this state. And once we get by the gubernatorial race here, a lot of us are going to start commenting about that because people have to understand just what he's doing, what he isn't doing. I mean, if he votes against this financial regulation bill, he ought to be ashamed of himself. So I hope he's going to come around on that, but you know, it's still very early. I mean, frankly, an approval rating of 55% is not a high approval rating. I mean, I remember my chief of staff, John Sasso, who would get very, very upset if my approval rating dropped below 60. And so you know, this is early number stuff. It's going to be a lot more important to see what he does, how he does it. And I'm not surprised that his numbers, so-called, look pretty good at this point in time. But it's a long 2 years plus before he's up for re-election. And we're going to take a good, hard look at what he's doing and what he's supporting and what he is supporting. Because particularly with this 60-vote filibuster thing, which I think is outrageous and probably unconstitutional, but you know, it's really just unacceptable that 41 people can stop 59 people from acting. I mean, if it hadn't been for the filibuster, which, by the way, has morphed into this 60-vote supermajority almost before our very eyes, we'd have had a health care bill and a good one back in July of last year. And so he's in a position where he can either make or break very important legislation.
He does.
So
Well,
you know, he's going to be very carefully scrutinized as time goes on here.
Well, I would think so. And you mentioned that you question the constitutionality of the whole filibuster situation. Say more about that, because that filibuster capability, the supermajorities, is a greater concern, it seems, all the time. What about the constitutional?
I think it's terrible, and I don't care who controls. I mean, both sides have abused it. But up until 10 or 15 years ago, it was never assumed that you had to have 60 votes to get anything done in the Senate. The filibuster was used very rarely.
But
the reason I think it's unconstitutional is because the Constitution is very explicit when it comes to supermajorities. There are only five situations under the Constitution, where you have to get more than 50% to get anything done. And they're extraordinary, removing the president, removing a member, ratifying treaties, amending the Constitution. I mean, these are explicitly provided in the Constitution. At the same time, it says, as you know, that the vice president can break a tie. Right. But if you need 60, you never have a tie. So what's the point of that? I don't think the framers of the Constitution ever intended that 60 votes be required to get anything done in the Senate of the United States, and it's a recipe for paralysis.
Yeah.
I mean, here we are bouncing around again with this financial regulation bill, which God knows we need badly and should have had in place years ago. And we're wondering, will there be a 60th vote? There's nothing in the Constitution that suggests that that was ever intended.
Yeah.
And we hear a lot about strict construction of the Constitution and reading it literally and those kinds of things. Well, this is, in my opinion, a perversion of majority rule. Now, Tom Harkin has been proposing a change in this for years, including, as he points out all the time, when he was in the minority. He says, look, if there's a group of people in the Senate who feel strongly about a bill, whether he agrees with them or not, they ought to have a right to debate it for 2 full days and then take a vote.
Yeah.
If you can't get 60, it drops to 57, they get another 2 days. If you can't get 57, it drops to 54, they get another 2 days. If it does, if you can't get 54, it drops to 51 and a simple majority. That gives this group 8 full days to debate things. Now, you and I are very familiar with the legislative process, right?
Oh,
I know
yes.
of no bill that requires more than 8 full days of debate. Do you?
Of course
before
not.
You take a vote on it?
No.
So I think that's eminently sensible, and I hope we can start developing some bipartisan support for this because, as I say, both sides have abused it, Democrats and Republicans alike. But we've got a new president, we've got new Congress, we have a lot of problems and a lot of challenges to face in this country. And as I said earlier, to permit 41 people to stop 59 people from acting, I think is just unconscionable. I think it's unacceptable. And we ought to get rid of it. The sooner the better. The same with these secret holds, which fortunately yeah. now apparently are being challenged. I mean, a senator can put a hold on an appointment, and nobody even knows who's done it. What kind of democracy is that? What kind of a legislative process is that?
Well,
So it's really just a terrible perversion of, I think, of the Constitution and of the whole legislative process. And I want to see people moving on this. I mean, this would be something that I'd like to see Brown get on, because he could make a real contribution to this.
Yeah.
As a Republican, and.
Well,
yeah, it would be a real step forward in terms of making it possible for the Congress to act deliberately, to be sure, after plenty of debate, but not in a way that permits a minority to paralyze the process.
We are talking with Governor Michael Dukakis, the 1988 presidential nominee, and it does seem that if Scott Brown were to do that, that would be quite the feather in his cap, and senators are always looking at the next election, and for him, it's coming up quicker than most.
Well, I think so. Now, obviously, he's going to have to take some heat from his fellow Republicans, but apparently he's already committed to voting to get rid of these so-called secret holds.
Well, that's good.
And I don't even understand the notion of a hold, Bert, do you? I mean, the president makes an appointment, and one individual can stop the Senate from acting?
Well, that's certainly not how we did things in the New Hampshire State Senate, and there are some parallels in terms of rules from the, you know, a state Senate to the U.S. Senate, but no, of course, that's absolutely impossible.
And within a reasonable period of time, you could act, right, by majority vote?
Of course.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to me it's a question of sort of politeness. Well, one of my colleagues doesn't want to do it, so we'll agree, wink, wink, nod, nod, that nobody's going to do anything about that. But that's it's certainly extra.
Not only that, but that colleague wasn't elected to be the president of the United States.
For sure.
And it's the president that makes these appointments, subject to approval by the Senate, although, frankly, I think the Senate spends much too much time confirming executive appointees. Okay, the cabinet, fine, but sub-cabinet officials, all these kinds of people, I don't know why the Senate, they got enough to do, frankly, to deal with the real problems that face this country without wasting our time and their time on the confirmation of some assistant secretary in some agency. I don't understand that either, to tell you the truth. But in the case of the halls, especially when it comes to judges, I just don't think there's any argument that you can make for the proposition that an individual senator can stop an appointment from going through indefinitely without, once again, 60 votes. Particularly when we don't even know who the senator is, to tell you the truth. And
secret.
That's just. I mean, we've both been legislators. We've had experience with this process. Sure, we believe that things ought to be considered carefully, but you got to act. And at some point, a simple majority of the body ought to have the right to act.
Well, I'm reminded of before, I think it was 1912 or 1913, the U.S. Senate was appointed by the legislatures of each state because, I guess, initially, the U.S. Senate was to be kind of the land of aristocrats. It's where they could be and support the upper body was there to be a bunch of aristocrats. But that was changed, and it seems to be kind of drifting back to that. And the
well, some of these Tea Party people want to go back to that. I mean, I can't imagine why they would. Certainly the American people wouldn't accept it for 1 minute. But these are interesting times, Bert, with interesting ideas. I mean, go out and ask the American people whether they want to have their right to elect their senators taken away from them. I think you and I know what they'll tell you. But some of these folks have interesting ideas, and they don't make a lot of sense to me, but that's a democracy. And by the way, that's what the Civil Liberties Union is all about, right? To make sure that they have the right to express these opinions and to take action politically if they want to, whether you and I agree with them or not.
Well, on the subject of Tea Party, we had to get to that now, didn't we, Governor? what do you make of the Tea Party anger now? I understand frustration at having a government not serve we, the people. You know, it's supposed to be governed of, by, and for the people. And it does seem to me that, well, to a significant extent, it has become more of a plutocracy, government of, by, and for the very wealthy. And yet the Tea Party people, I don't know, they don't seem to be as concerned about that. What's your take on the Tea Party anger?
Well, I think a lot of this is just anger at what happened to us, particularly in the course of this very serious recession that we've been going through. But what I don't understand is their prescription to correct it. They want less government, but not when oil is pouring into the Gulf. And I would assume not when we virtually deregulated our financial institutions and they almost brought us down.
Well,
And the notion that somehow you can shrink the government and deal with these problems is absurd. Not only that, but a lot of these folks are on Medicare and Social Security, and they like it, and they're very happy about it, but any notion that we might extend it to include folks under the age of 65 who can't get affordable health insurance is immediately met with this response that it's socialism. So it's really puzzling to me, but look, we've always had folks that have been out there with who've been angry. And so, and I remember, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but I remember the billboards in the Midwest in the 1950s advocating the impeachment of Earl Warren.
Oh, yes.
I certainly remember the McCarthy era, which was a very scary time in American history, and far worse than anything that we've been going through. And so, you know, there have always been movements like this, and fortunately, the country seems to be strong enough and resilient enough to kind of come back to the center and to kind of get its bearings. But you're going to see this kind of thing, particularly, for example, the immigration issue. Immigration always becomes an issue when we go into a recession, and for good reason. People are out of work, and they resent the fact that other people who are here illegally may be holding jobs that otherwise might be theirs. Now, these aren't great jobs. In fact, a lot of these illegal immigrants are exploited terribly.
Yes, for sure.
But unhappiness over immigration always surfaces when we get into trouble economically, and that's understandable, Bert. So we've seen this before, and I think unless and until we get ourselves out of this mess, and we're gradually doing so, although I'm very concerned now about this sudden preoccupation with the deficit. You know, we went through this during the Great Depression. And in fact, Franklin Roosevelt himself in 1937 decided that it was time to start tightening up and and not continue to try to stimulate the economy. And we went into a second near depression.
Absolutely.
With 18% unemployment. And I hope we've learned from experience and from history about this. I'm concerned about the deficit. I'm concerned about the fact that under Bush, the national debt was doubled when Clinton, who preceded him, had not only given us the first budgetary surplus in 40 years, but in fact left office with a budgetary surplus of $250 billion and a plan to eliminate the national debt in 10 to 12 years. Remember that?
Yeah, I do.
And by 2-1, the American people said, forget about your tax cut, do what Clinton is proposing, because the savings from that were then going to be banked and would fund Social Security for another 75 years. And by 2-1, the American people said, that's the right thing to do. Frankly, it's the conservative thing to do in a fiscal sense. Let's do it. Well, we didn't elect Bush, but in any event, he got himself into office.
Yes.
And the next thing you know, we've doubled the national debt in 8 years. And I find that frankly appalling, but at this point in time, when you face the kind of economic situation that Obama faced, you can't start cutting back and trying to balance your budget if you want to stimulate this economy. Now, we were, thanks to the stimulus plan and other things, we were starting to come out of this thing.
Yeah.
And it's very important that we continue to do so.
Well,
and if we continue on the course that he set for us, within a year or two or three, we'll start coming out. And then revenues will start coming into the federal treasury because the economy begins to revive and expand, and we'll be in a lot better shape. But this is no time to decide we're going to balance the budget.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding the fact that had we followed the Clinton plan, which, by the way, had Gore been elected and installed in office,
he may have been elected,
the plan that we would have followed.
Yes.
We would now be in a situation with little or no national debt, and in a position to stimulate the economy without being concerned about massive deficits and this kind of thing. And the one thing that really puzzles me, Bert, I don't quite understand this, is that a lot of the folks on the Republican side who are running against incumbent Democrats are basically proposing that we go back and do what got us into this mess in the first place. And I just don't understand that.
Well, one thing
it's too bad that in 2000, when Clinton, in his last address to the Congress, laid out this plan for taking that surplus and driving down, eliminating the national debt in 10 to 12 years, and putting us on a very solid financial footing. It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that a conservative president, so-called, came in and basically blew it up and created the conditions that we're now facing.
We are talking with Governor Mike Dukakis. I'm reminded, Governor, as you speak about, I'm not sure if it was 1952 or 56 when Adlai Stevenson was the Democratic nominee. And the story is that a supporter came up to Adlai Stevenson and said, Senator, or maybe it was Governor.
Governor, I guess, yeah.
It was Governor. All thinking Americans will vote for you. And his answer was, well, that's great, but I need a majority.
Well, look, the American people, by and large, are pretty smart, let me tell you. You know, their response, for example, to the Clinton plan for using the surplus to retire the national debt and to put us on a very firm footing financially and to forego any tax cut until we did that, tells you something about them and about their willingness to deal with these kinds of issues. But, look, you're going to have people on both ends of the spectrum that take extreme positions, and that's always been the case and will continue to be the case.
The concern I have is about not just money in politics, but now celebrity in politics. There's some new thing on Facebook about who has more Facebook friends. Is it, I think it's Lady Gaga or Barack Obama. Since when was it about celebrity as much as it seems to be now? You know, people don't
have... Well, it's always been part of the American political scene. I mean, you know, when you go back in history, we've had celebrities who have run for office. Some of them have been elected, some of them haven't been elected.
Yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger wasn't the first
that's true.
So, movie figure to get elected to public office, needless to say.
Yeah.
And there'll be others that come along, but...
Wouldn't it be nice if we could actually run on issues, you know, and get back to that?
Yeah, we are. And by the way, you know, I teach at UCLA during January, February, and March, and in fact, I teach a course called California Policy Issues.
Oh, my goodness.
Courses I teach out there. And Schwarzenegger's an interesting guy, and let me tell you, he's no dope. I mean, he's got... He's interesting. He's got interesting ideas. Very strongly committed to the environment. He's a big fan of high-speed rail, which obviously endears him to me, as you can imagine.
Yes.
But the one thing he hasn't been willing to confront is the state's fiscal situation.
Yeah.
You know, he told people they could borrow their way out of this mess. You and I know you can't borrow your way out of large operating deficits, and you got to bite the bullet either by cutting spending or raising taxes or both, and you got to have the guts to be able to stand up and say that. But he's just, that's the one thing he hasn't done. But he's an interesting guy, and he's got interesting ideas. And as I say, had he been able to deal forcefully with the fiscal situation, he would have gone down as a very effective governor. Unfortunately, he leaves with mountains of red ink, and that's not going to be easy to solve.
No, but, for the next
celebrity's part of life, and... you know, it's one thing that I think we've all got to accept, particularly in an age when it's 724 with media and stuff. But by and large, we're still trying to elect decent people, I think, for the most part. And you and I both serve with them. The folks that run for public office want to do the right thing, and they're in it for the right reasons. And that's going to continue. And frankly, one of the reasons I love teaching, and I spend a lot of time speaking on college campuses, try to encourage young people to do this.
Yeah.
And believe me, particularly since Obama, the level of interest in public service among young people in this country has just skyrocketed. It's very much like what it was when John Kennedy was elected. Same kind of reaction, same kind of response from young people. And I think it's terrific.
Wow, that is great to hear. I'm glad you're hearing that. It's nice to have little bits and pieces of hope now and then. We do need young people.
Well, believe me, we're producing some great kids in this country.
Wow,
Britt, I mean, they're terrific. I teach them all the time, both here and on the West Coast, and I'm very encouraged by these young people.
Well, that's good to hear. Burt Cohen here. It is the Burt Cohen Show. We're talking with the 1988 presidential nominee, Michael Dukakis, and I'll throw a softball to you here. How hurtful to American values and reputation were the Bush-Cheney years?
Well, I think they hurt us badly. I mean, I thought it was the worst national administration I'd ever lived under. And what was so puzzling about it was that it was anything but a conservative administration.
Right, for sure. What did they conserve?
In some cases, that was okay. Whatever one thinks of the No Child Left Behind legislation, it happened to be the most intrusive national legislation ever passed in the field of public education, pushed hard by a president whose principal ally, as you'll recall, was Ted Kennedy.
Yes.
Who strongly believed that every kid in this country ought to have a shot at a decent education.
Absolutely.
But there was nothing conservative about invading Iraq. In fact, that was a radical step. People like Pat Buchanan strongly opposed it.
Yes.
Said we had no business going in there, and the effort by Bush and Cheney, particularly, to argue that the president had almost unlimited power to do anything he wanted to do. What's conservative about that? I mean, the framers of the United States Constitution would be rolling over in their graves.
Absolutely.
Hearing that,
absolutely,
they deliberately drafted and passed the Constitution to limit the power of government, and especially the president,
and the war making powers.
Were very fearful, as you know, of kings, of dictators, of aristocracy, and so on. So There was nothing particularly conservative, in my judgment, playing fast and loose with people's civil rights and civil liberties.
Yeah.
Using torture as an instrument of American foreign policy. What's conservative about that?
It's amazing how they can ascribe the word conservative to such things.
Well,
I certainly
that's not conservatism in any sense of the word. And I just thought it was not only a bad 8 years, but they left us with this shambles of an economy. And you know, thousands, millions of Americans being hurt by this, losing their opportunity to earn a living, losing their homes. I just thought it was one of the worst administrations, the worst that I'd ever lived under, to tell you the truth.
Well, certainly. And
one of the worst in history.
I never dreamed, being a patriotic American growing up in Massachusetts, that there'd ever be a United States that had at its policy torture. It's just absolutely just beyond my imagination.
And just the other day he said he'd do it again.
I know.
I don't understand that. But
I don't either. And Obama certainly has a heck of a lot on his plate right now. Now, the Obama...
He does, but he's ticking them off one at a time. He's done the health care thing.
Yeah.
He's done the stimulus package, and don't kid yourself, without the stimulus package, we would be in terrible shape financially.
That's
and I hope the Senate will finally get off the dime and make it possible at least for state and local governments not to have to lay off thousands of people because they've refused to provide some additional support at the state and local level during the recession. And that's all that we're asking for.
And it's been amazing to me how some of the Republicans have been against the financial reform that's moving through the House and Senate right now, saying, you know, they don't want to intrude on people's freedom. Well, you know, isn't this supposed to be a government that serves all the people, not just the powerful interests? And, you know, FDR, one of our greatest presidents, in my opinion, certainly, I think probably most people, he wanted to have government, well, at least in his first term, more powerful than the private interests. Yet today it seems that government appears to be, in many cases down in Washington, just a servant of the few powerful special interests. How can
that's always the tension, right? I mean, you've been in the middle of the legislative process. So have I. I mean, that's always the challenge. How do you try to represent the public interest in the face of powerful and well-financed private interests?
Yeah.
And we all face that. But if history teaches us anything, it's that you've got to regulate the hell out of financial institutions.
Yes.
You know, I was down doing a TV thing in Charlotte, North Carolina, not too long ago, and we got into this question. I said, you know, I think it's time for us to go back to the days when banking was boring. Remember? When your banker was a guy that you knew in the community, he cared about the community, but he also insisted that you make a reasonable down payment, and that you had decent enough credit so that you could pay off your mortgage or pay off your loan. Then Wall Street got invaded. First, we broke this wall between
The Glass-Steagall Act,
regular banking, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah,
which was probably a mistake. Bill Clinton said it was the biggest mistake he made as president of the United States.
I think he was right.
And signing the repeal of the Glass-Steagall.
Yes.
Which, as you know, was the product of a similar meltdown in 1929, and of New Deal action. You know, we've got a Wall Street that's full of these hotshots with their computers, and a lot of what they do doesn't seem to me to contribute anything to the overall economic well-being of the country, but it certainly contributes a lot to their pocketbooks. So I'm all for a tough financial regulation bill. In fact, I'm concerned that it doesn't do enough to cut down these too big to fail banks to size. I think there ought to be a separation.
Yes.
And
in any event,
as the Greeks say, you know, pathema mathema, things happen, you're supposed to learn from them and not keep repeating the same mistakes over and over again.
I'm going to have to learn that Greek phrase after this show here. That is a good one.
It's a good one, and it rhymes.
Well, there is something about the one thing we learn from history is that we never learn from history.
Well, you hope we learn from history. And that's particularly true when it comes to financial institutions. They must be regulated thoughtfully, responsibly, but they must be regulated.
We are talking with Governor Mike Dukakis. What about Obama? Talk about learning from history. Afghanistan, digging deeper and deeper and deeper, and he's pledged to continue the policy here. What about Obama and Afghanistan? Certainly his base, the Democrats, don't seem to support it, and a lot of genuine conservatives don't support
Bert,
it as
it's,
well.
It's a very tough issue. If you were to say to me, Dukakis, if you were in the White House, what would you do? I'd have the same challenges and the same questions that he's had and a lot of us have had. I thought invading Iraq was one of the dumbest things we ever did.
Yeah.
And here we are now, years later with thousands of young Americans, for that matter, Iraqis, who've lost their lives, been maimed, and so on. And a country which really isn't a country can't seem to get its act together. Afghanistan's different, I think, because, for one thing, going in there had very strong international support. And secondly, they were the people that essentially gave safe harbor to Osama bin Laden and made it possible for him to direct this terrible, terrible tragedy. That took place in New York City, among other things. And I don't think you can simply do nothing about that. But if you were to say to me, what would you do?
Yes.
I'm not sure it would be much different from what the president is trying to do, because I don't think we have an option of simply walking away from the place. Now, what that ought to be, how you do it, how you approach it, is something that I'm not sure I can give you chapter and verse on. The president has said that by 2011, we're going to start pulling out. And that should be enough time. Good Lord, that'll be 10 years that we've been in Afghanistan. I agree with him. I agree with him. If in another year we are in a position to begin withdrawing our forces, then our policy will have failed. And in any event, there's no sense in continuing a failed policy.
Well,
So I think it's a tough one. And I know lots of people are unhappy. I'm unhappy. But I can't give you an alternative that I'm happy about either. And I think that's probably true of most of us.
Again, we're talking on the Bert Cohen Show with former presidential nominee Mike Dukakis. And one of the events that President Obama certainly could never have expected is the oil gusher. Is President Obama missing a chance to unite the nation with a clear, bold energy policy? Energy was certainly a big issue when you were running for president.
Well, he's got a bold energy policy, and he said it over and over again. Climate change is real.
Yes.
And these people that don't think it's real must have blinders on.
Yeah.
Climate change is real, and he talked about it during the campaign. He's pushed climate change legislation, and the Congress is moving much too slowly on it, though the House, as you know, acted last year. Another example of this 60-vote thing.
Yeah.
If you didn't have that filibuster rule, we'd have climate change legislation moving through the Senate. So he's been very outspoken on that. Now, what do you do under these circumstances? Well, I had a mini experience like this when I was governor during my first term. Do you remember the Argo Merchant?
Oh, yes.
That sprung a leak?
Yeah.
I think it was the Argo Merchant. Maybe wrong. But anyway, we had a tanker that was coming up between the islands and Cape Cod and developed a serious leak, and oil began spewing into the ocean. And I went through a 6 or 7 or 8 day period when we were trying to do something about it, and it was exceedingly difficult. I mean, for one thing, and maybe this is a wrong assumption, you make the assumption that the oil companies at least know something about their job.
Part of it.
Deal with this.
Yeah, at least part of it.
Secondly, as you know, we had 8 years where the federal regulatory agencies basically walked off the job. I mean, we had the number two guy in the Bush Interior Department was a lobbyist for the coal industry, and essentially, Bush salted these folks all over these regulatory agencies, and many of them came out of the companies that they were supposed to be regulating. It was really outrageous.
Yeah.
So regulation was lax. But when it happens, And you've got an outfit like BP, which ironically, as you probably know, was the greenest of the oil companies.
Absolutely.
I mean, BP was way out front on alternative energy, on going green, on moving as rapidly as possible away from fossil fuel into alternative, yes, non-polluting forms of energy.
They were out front.
I think you probably are entitled to the assumption that they know what they're doing, and with strong pushing from federal authorities and the new Secretary of the Interior, who's a very good guy, they'll clean it up. And in point of fact, that didn't happen. But I think he deserves a lot of credit for extracting this commitment to a $20 billion fund.
Yes.
I don't think you're going to see any lax regulation around the place under this administration. And it's just a terrible environmental tragedy, which I think probably could have been avoided had we had some really tough regulators running the show.
Well, certainly.
The past 8 years, but in any event, he's got to deal with it. And as I say, I remember having to deal with a mini version of this. I mean, it was like a teacup compared to what's been going on down there.
Well,
and just being so concerned about the impact on the Cape and our economy and all this kind of stuff. Fortunately, we were able to stop it. But
couldn't there be a kind of a combined solution of stimulating the economy with some deficit spending, some creation of public works jobs like Franklin Roosevelt so famously did, so successfully did, doing that in the energy direction, actually having government-funded, taxpayer-funded jobs, public works jobs to build new solar panels in the Southwest and wind turbines wherever, and to have all these decentralized power capabilities, so to stimulate the economy, create actual jobs, and really get us off oil. This doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, there's a lot. I mean, the stimulus package itself has a lot of money in it for alternative forms of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big industry out there. I don't think you have to create a WPA to do this. There's a huge industry. In fact, I have a son-in-law out in Denver, Colorado, who my Republican son-in-law, who I love dearly, but he's in the alternative energy business. I mean, there are plenty of people out there willing to do this. My concern with the stimulus package isn't the stimulus package. In fact, I think we need more stimulus.
Yes.
It's that I think a lot of this stuff isn't moving fast enough. I mean, you take the infrastructure stuff. Now, some of that has to do with the fact that the states weren't ready for this, that they didn't have on-the-shelf projects ready to go.
Mm.
They should have, but they didn't. And some of it is that, at least in the case of alternative energy, it takes some time to get this money moving into the pipeline. But if I have one criticism of the stimulus package, it is that I'm not seeing enough people out there working.
Right.
I see the signs, but I don't see a lot of workers. And as I say, you don't have to create a WPA here. There are plenty of folks. I mean, this is a terrific time to invest in infrastructure. Contractors are hungry.
Yeah.
They're bidding low. We've got 30% unemployment in the construction trades. What better time to go out there and rebuild our infrastructure, get serious about high-speed rail, build some transit systems in our major cities, and move this stuff. And the more that we can do, the better, frankly. We're way behind. Friends in Europe and in Asia are putting us in their rearview mirror. You go to Europe, as you know, and you ride on 200-mile-an-hour trains. You come back here, and with the exception of the Acela, and you're putzing along at 80 miles an hour, which we were doing 100 years ago. And, you know, it's really kind of pathetic. The Chinese are now connecting all of their provincial capitals with 225-mile-an-hour trains, and they don't take forever to do it. This is all going to be completed by 2015, Bert.
And
now they're in California offering to show California how to do their high-speed rail system. It's the Chinese.
Why aren't we doing that? I know that, you know, you were really interested in Amtrak, which is...
No leadership. I mean, George Bush wouldn't have known a train if it had hit him between the eyes. I'm serious. I mean, had no interest at all in this. And
is Obama paying enough attention to it?
Yeah, much more so. And he's got a vice president, you know, who's strongly pro-rail.
Yes.
And used to ride Amtrak from Wilmington to D.C. every day. But we finally have an administration. This is the first time in my lifetime we have an administration, at least since Abraham Lincoln pushed the Transcontinental Railroad right in the middle of the Civil War, that is serious about transit and about high-speed inner-city rail. But as you know, most of these projects, when it comes to actual design and construction, are done at the state level. It's like the interstate highway system. You have a national system, but who did the work? Who does the work? It's the states, right? It's the New Hampshire Highway Department.
Sure.
Massachusetts Highway Department, and so on.
As it should be.
And we're just way behind when it comes to expertise, technology, and an understanding of what it takes to build first-class high-speed rail systems. We finally have a New England regional rail plan now, signed off on by all of the New England governors, so we can qualify for some of this money, but we were a day late and a dollar short when it came to that. I mean, look at New Hampshire. Should we have modern high-speed rail from Concord, New Hampshire, to Boston? I'll say.
Absolutely.
Any question about it? Look at I-93 at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and you don't have to even ask yourself that question.
Yeah.
But, frankly, New Hampshire has taken a long time to decide. I don't even know if the state has decided whether it really wants to do this. And that's a relatively inexpensive project.
Yeah.
But it doesn't take a lot. You've got an existing right-of-way. You can get speeds up to 110, 115 miles an hour. Why aren't we working on that? Why aren't we putting people at work doing it? I don't get it.
I wish I knew.
But I'll tell you, the countries with whom we compare ourselves are way out in front of this.
Yeah.
New England, Europe in the next 4, 5, 6 years will be fully integrated. We'll have a fully integrated high-speed rail system connecting every one of the major Western European and Central European countries. Talked about China. Japan has been doing this for years. I mean, you want to go from Tokyo to Kyoto, get on a train, you're down there in 2 hours and 15 minutes. And by the way, they run every 12 minutes from 6 o'clock in the morning till 9 o'clock at night.
Well, I haven't been there, but
I do like trains. It really is embarrassing. And when you say, well, why haven't we done this? I don't know. We've been spending billions on highways and airports, virtually nothing on high-speed intercity rail, and it shows. So well, I hope we can use this opportunity. Another example, Britt, of how something like a very severe recession can stimulate us to get going on stuff that we should have been working on years ago.
Absolutely, and I think people would welcome the high-speed rail here that the public is with.
No question about it.
Yeah, we'd love
to take
it.
Not just here, all over the country.
Yeah.
All over the country. I mean, the initial appropriation, the stimulus package for high-speed rail was $8 billion, which was about eight times what we had ever spent before.
Yeah.
You know how many applications came in for the states?
How many?
Over $100 billion.
Oh, my.
For that $8 billion.
Oh.
Which tells you something about the pent-up demand for this. I mean, people are fed up with highways that are moving parking lots at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. They're fed up with going to the airport for flights of 200, 300, 400 miles and having to take their shoes off and stand around and all this kind of stuff. I mean, high-speed rail is not only energy efficient, far greener than the alternatives,
oh, yeah,
but it's much more convenient.
Well, wasn't it the case in the 50s when the national highway system was built that, frankly, the trucking lobby had a lot to do with moving dollars from railroad into highway construction? I wonder if that...
I'm not sure I blame the lobbies. I mean, look, we all were going to drive, right?
Oh,
we
yeah.
came out of World War II. We hadn't had a new car in 5 years. I remember I was a kid, Bert, when the first new car started arriving in our neighborhood. 1945, 46, the first Hudson, the first Studebaker, the first Nash.
Yeah, there was some good cars.
I don't know if you're old enough to remember those cars. But
well,
you're just a young kid, relatively. But we just everybody's going to buy a car, and they were reasonably inexpensive.
Yeah, but now
and,
we're ready for something.
They were so convenient and all that kind of stuff. But
we love our cars, but we're ready for public transportation.
No question.
No question at all.
And unfortunately, we lost a real opportunity to do that. I mean, take a look at Boston now. Fortunately, we have a first-class public transportation system, one of the best in the country. But there's a gap here. It's 1 mile between South and North Station.
Oh, yes.
Right?
And I wanted to ask about that.
Does that make any sense?
No.
It's absurd.
What can be done about that?
We could take 60,000 cars off the road every day simply by connecting those two stations. Now, our plans were to do it as part of the big dig. I won't get into the story about how, unfortunately, we lost that opportunity. But in any event, it's still possible to do this, to do it at a reasonable cost, to do it quickly, to do it with very little disruption of the city, because all of the mitigation has now been done as a result of the big dig. So, and by the way, the technology of tunneling has improved dramatically. And they have these deep boring machines now that can do this and do it with little or no disruption above them. So why don't we do it? mean, what are we talking about?
I'd like to know. I'll tell you, if we could connect North and South Station, make a huge difference on our highways.
Oh, God.
Just
yeah,
absolutely.
Not only that, we ought to be working on rail to Montreal. I mean, Montreal and the Maritimes ought to be connected to New England. There's strong ties there, lots of movement back and forth. And it's very exciting, I think. I mean, it's a terrific opportunity to do something that we should have been doing a long time ago. But, you know, it needs a sense of urgency. And one of the things that I hope the president and the vice president will do is start getting the governors together and saying, look, folks, we got to start moving on this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, it shouldn't take Massachusetts 8 years to extend the Green Line 4 miles from Lechmere to Tufts over an existing right-of-way. You know, Irish and Chinese immigrants were laying 4 miles of track a day, Bert, in 1867 on the Transcontinental Railroad. It takes us 8 years to go 4 miles, extend the light rail line. I mean, this is...
Well, maybe that's one absurd reason why you were the 1988 nominee and governor of Massachusetts, because you have optimism. You have a vision that we can do this stuff. We have an election coming up pretty darn quickly in November 2010. Do you believe the Democratic majorities in the House and to a lesser degree in the Senate can possibly hold in the upcoming elections in the...
Yeah, I think they can hold. I think Democrats have a very good story to tell, notwithstanding the fact that we're still working hard to come out of this recession. And as I said, if I were running against a Republican who was advocating essentially the policies that got us into this mess in the first place, I think I'd have a field day. Because I can't imagine people wanting to go back to that if this is carefully explained. Now, there's one other thing we've got to do.
Yes.
And as you know, I'm kind of obsessive on this. We've got to organize and campaign at the grassroots. You know, we'll never outspend the other side or outraise them.
Yeah.
But we can certainly outwork them. And if there's one lesson to be learned from Barack Obama's victory in 2008, it is that precinct-based grassroots organizing works.
Yes.
And I wish I could tell you that I think all of the Democrats that I know learned that lesson, but I'm not sure. But if these members of Congress and candidates for Congress want to win, as Democrats, they better organize. And I have to tell you, you've been doing this yourself for a long time. It's a precinct captain and 6 blocker neighborhood captains in every precinct, making personal contact with every single voting household on an ongoing basis. That's what it is. It doesn't cost a lot, and it's by far the most effective way to organize a campaign.
So even in the face of the Facebooks and the Twitters and all that stuff, it's the person, you know, there's always discussions.
That doesn't get you elected. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, the Internet is a wonderful organizing tool. It's a fundraising tool. Look at Obama. He had 4 million contributors and raised $750 million.
Yeah.
The vast majority of it from small, modest contributions.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the best way to raise money. And the Internet was extremely helpful in that. So don't get me wrong.
Right.
The technology is a great organizing tool, but that isn't what gets you elected, as we both know.
You need an air war and a ground war. A ground
yes,
war
indeed.
Is absolutely yes, indeed. Very important. Well, Governor Dukakis, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to hear from you and to hear your optimism and practicality. It's a good couple of things to combine, optimism and practicality.
Well, you're nice to say that.
Well, thank you so much, and my best regards to Kitty and all the family.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. We've been talking with Governor Mike Dukakis, and this song was his campaign theme song in 1988. It's from an LP, as you can tell. Bert Cohen here. Email me, bert@bertcohen.com.
country tis of thee,
good day.
Sweet land of liberty,
good day.
Of thee I sing,
good day.
Of thee I sing.
Well, that was a long ending. Neil Diamond, America, Mike Dukakis' campaign theme song from 1988. Thanks very much for being with us on The Burt Cohen Show.